The writer Jack Davis says there are a lot of reasons bald eagles are just amazing creatures. And one of them is they have what he describes as ideal family values. Bald eagles are terrific parents and mates. In his new book, Davis says after breeding season, an eagle couple will go their separate ways for a few months, but every year they will meet back at the same nest. Now, there are good logical reasons for this, but Davis suggests another possibility. Maybe, he says in the book, it's love. And there's a story he tells to make his point.
John James Audubon traveled all about North America, mostly east of the Mississippi, to catalog birds and to observe them, paint them. And in doing so, he shot birds out of the sky. In 1820, he's traveling down the Mississippi. He spots a bald eagle and he shoots it out of the sky and it falls into the water. And he and his companions bring it on board their boat. And the mate happened to be in the area and was witnessing this. And the mate is in the air circling and screeching. The mate is outraged by what happened. Bald eagles mate for life. When I was doing my research, I came across a number of stories of bald eagles being shot and falling out of the sky and a mate witnessing it and raising Cain, if you will, with the shooters, even swooping down trying to attack them, desperate to save its mate if at all possible. Love is not exclusive to human species. It's not beyond birds or other animals. Animals have feelings like us. They have emotions like us. Those mates that were circling, desperate to save their potentially lost one, in most cases they were lost, may have been expressing grief out of love.
In that story, you mentioned that the bird itself wanted to survive. So did its mate watching from above. And it kind of gets to something that you write about, that in the two different times in American history when we almost eradicated them from the earth, it wasn't just humans that helped bring eagles back. It was the eagles themselves. What does this say about the eagles, that they deserve a good share of the credit for their survival?
As an environmental writer, I'm always conscious of nature's agency in the story or in history. And I think that's a good example of bald eagles really in part controlling their own destiny apart from us. And, you know, every species has an instinct for survival. And the bald eagles is exceedingly strong. You know, the bald eagle, according to fossil evidence, has been around a million years. It's experienced this earth much longer than we have. And ultimately, if we don't continue on this earth, my guess is that bald eagles will still be around. That's what kind of survivors they are. Survival comes first for bald eagles.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Jack Davis is joining us to talk about his natural and cultural history of the bald eagle. And he lays out these two periods when we indiscriminately killed them, like the bison, like the passenger pigeon. Only this one is a success story. And Davis explains how. How despite the fact that we used eagles as the symbol for our country, we nearly lost them twice. And twice, people helped get them back. And it was this part of the story that made Davis want to write about them in the first place.
Readers are subjected to a lot of doom and gloom. And so I wanted to offer readers a break and provide them with a story that is more positive, that I think in many ways could provide a model for us as we deal with the environmental challenges of the 21st century. It's a remarkable conservation success story on the part of both American people and the bald eagle.
You write early in the book that history has failed to give the successful effort to stop the slaughter of eagles its fair due.
Yeah. You know, we know about the slaughter of the bison, of course, and loss of many species such as the passenger pigeon and the Carolina parakeet. And we're aware, mostly aware, of the DDT years and its impact on bird life and even the bald eagle. And other raptors like the osprey. The osprey was hit nearly as, if not as hard as the bald eagle, California condor too. But we don't hear about that earlier period when we pushed the bald eagle to the brink of extinction a first time in the late 19th, early 20th century. And that was, whereas DDT was an indirect assault on bald eagles, the first assault was a direct assault. And that was the result of human activity. We regarded the bald eagle as a predator, which it is, but we put it in the same category as wolves and coyotes and mountain lions and bears, and it was a predator that was to be eradicated.
You write in the book that the bald eagle ultimately concerns itself with connections. Before we jump into some details, what do you mean by that part, the connections part?
Yeah, this story of the bald eagle is really one about connections, you know, that most obviously the connection between the American people and bald eagles, but also between nature and humanity and nature and the human experience. And I see nature as a driving force in the human experience. Nature has shapes the course of human history. That's something that most historians don't particularly recognize. But as an environmental writer and as somebody writing about a bird that had this and continues to have this intimate relationship with the American people, I'm very much interested in connections, again, human to nature, and from one time period to the other time period, and biographical connections between people and also between people and wildlife.
Let me ask you about the part of the book where you explain the relationship between bald eagles in American history. And one part of the story you tell of the United States relationship with those birds is that it turns out the eagle is actually not the national bird. That surprised me.
It surprised me too. You know, when I started writing this book or started researching it, I assumed like everybody else that the bald eagle is our national bird. What other bird could be the national bird, right?
Right.
But
right.
As it happens, we have no national bird. Congress has never designated a national bird as it has designated a national mammal, which is the bison, and a national tree, which is the oak. And in tomorrow, Congress indeed could choose a national bird that's not the bald eagle. I don't think that would happen.
It seems like there are a lot of myths about all of this. And one of the most well-known is this idea that Benjamin Franklin didn't want the bald eagle as the national symbol. He didn't want it on the seal of the country. He wanted the turkey. You looked into this in the book. Is there any truth to that story?
Well, it's a mythic story, but as with many mythic stories, there is some element of truth. Now, he did say in a letter to his daughter, Sarah Bach, he did say that he was sorry that the bald eagle had been chosen as the symbol of our country. But he did compare the morality of the bald eagle with the wild turkey. He described the wild turkey as a brave and hardworking, whereas the bald eagle was this rank coward and thief. But he never said he wanted the wild turkey to be the bird of his country. Now, he did have his own opinion about what should go on the front of the Great Seal. And, of course, what's on the front now is the bald eagle. He had another idea altogether, which I'm not going to share with your readers.
Because, good. Okay.
Yeah. I want them.
It's crazy.
It's absolutely crazy. I had no idea. It blew my mind when I learned that. And I should point out that he was appointed to the first committee.
Yeah.
But that's what makes writing fun often, you know, all these surprises you encounter along the way.
Well, the Franklin part, seeing the the eagle is somehow being cowardly gets to kind of this important theme in the book, how the, you know, the bald eagle may have, you know, looked majestic, but for much of our history, it had this terrible reputation. Franklin, as you say, believed the eagle was lazy, that it stole the hard-earned prey from other birds, that its behavior certainly wasn't noble. And this idea just stuck with the bald eagle for some reason. Talk about that.
It did. It stuck with the bald eagle through well into the 20th century. And I think part of that has to do with the way humans anthropomorphize, you know, wildlife. And so we attach these descriptive labels to them, such as noble, courageous, cowardly. The bald eagle does steal from other birds. It steals from other eagles, as a matter of fact. It particularly steals from osprey. Ospreys are excellent fishers, better fishers than bald eagles. The bald eagle probably says, why not? You know, you know, that osprey has a fish, I want it, and it'll go after it. And that's, you know, was a very common sight in Ben Franklin's day. And now that the bald eagle population is coming back, more and more people are witnessing the so-called theft. And bald eagles often hunt for the perch because, you know, from a perch tree usually, or a post or a rooftop, they have tremendous eyesight. They can see clearly a mile or two away, and they can see in color spectrums that that humans can't see, as all birds can. And so let's say a mile away, they can see a white rabbit in the white snow a mile away. That rabbit is not camouflaged from it. They can see a gray squirrel in a tree. It's not camouflaged from the bald eagle. And so they depend upon their eyesight and their speed for hunting.
So they're described as lazy. They're described as thieves. But this is kleptoparasites, right? There is a reason for this. It's a sign of intelligence. It doesn't mean they're actually stealing something. I mean, you dig into that in the book as well.
Yeah, scientists now maintain that the kind of thievery that John James Audubon and Ben Franklin accused the bald eagle of is actually smart behavior. And it's not exclusive to bald eagles. A lot of animals in the wild steal. I mean, every one of us has been out on the beach and we're eating a bag of Cheetos, and who's the first one to show up? It's the gulls, you know.
Yeah.
And it's smart behavior. It's a good way to conserve energy. And that's what that's the priority of animals, to conserve energy and feed. And so if the bald eagle can steal food and conserve energy, it will do that.
Why did it take 6 years for this committee to finally say, all right, the bald eagle is going to be on the national seal? Because you do mention there were other common figures on national coats of arms, the lions and dragons and stags. There were all kinds of different ideas that were coming up. There were recommendations for a flock of birds and sheep, a kettle of fish, rattlesnakes, all kinds of things. How did we finally end up with the eagle?
Well, it took so long. I guess we could make the argument that it took so long because Congress was in charge, yes. And it took nearly as long to devise a great seal that Congress could agree on as it did to win the revolution. And it took three committees, some 14 men, and multiple artists and consultants. And I think the delegates to Congress, members of Congress, just weren't sure what – I mean, this is a brand new nation, right? It's a young nation who wants to distinguish itself from European countries, and it wants to emphasize its sovereignty. It doesn't want to be seen as an offspring of Great Britain. And so those who were in the position to develop a seal were, I think, you know, doing a lot of experimenting and guessing what actually fit well with the United States. Finally, in 1782, Charles Thompson, who had been Secretary of Congress throughout this, finally said, enough is enough. I guess I'm going to have to do this myself. And he's the person who came up with the idea of putting a bald eagle on the Great Seal of the United States. And he insisted that it be a bald eagle. And I think it's a brilliant choice. Again, this is a nation wanting to distinguish itself as all-American, and the bald eagle lives only in North America. It's truly an all-American bird, and it embodies the kind of attributes that, or at least from our perspective, these kind of attributes that we associated with the nation or still do, and with the people of the nation, you know, strength and courage and sovereignty or freedom.
One of the things you mentioned is that there had been eagles throughout human history on coats of arms and all kinds of things. But this was interesting. I didn't realize this, that they were just a kind of vague idea of an eagle. It wasn't a particular eagle necessarily.
That's right. And I like to say they're non-ornithological eagles.
Right.
And, you know, eagles have been on coats of arms and seals of nation states dating back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, a very popular image. But again, none of these eagles prior to 1782 represent any particular species. The bald eagle was the first identifiable eagle species on a nation state seal. And I should say there are some 60 eagle species around the world. But the ones you see prior to that of the United States, they're typically all black. They often had crests to make them look more fearsome, a writhing tongue, red talons, and sometimes a red beak.
You described and this made sense to me when you the way you put it, the "don't tread on me" stare of the bald eagle, which is sort of an effect because of the brow ridge on a bald eagle.
That's right. You know, the more I looked at the bald eagle and of course I think we're all familiar with that brow ridge or the supraorbital bone, and which acts as a sun visor, the best we can tell for bald eagles. But when you look at a bald eagle, it really does largely because of that ridge, but also it has these bright yellow eyes that are nearly the size of an adult human's eyes. And it does indeed have that "don't tread on me" stare, which is another reason why I think the bald eagle is a brilliant selection for the Great Seal of the United States.
Maybe this is too much of a diversion, but I did want to ask you, because one of the things you write about is how the bald eagle became a symbol that appealed to the male ego. And this sort of gendered idea surprised me, but I guess it's right. I mean, for a time, it didn't seem right to be a symbol for women's groups or for women. I mean, society, you said, expected women to be, you know, represented as songbirds and doves, but not raptors.
That's right. I mean, raptors are, again, they tend to be apex species. And, of course, males have traditionally or historically regarded them as the apex among the sexes. And women, you know, throughout the 19th and well into the 20th century tended to respect that hierarchy among the sexes. And so my guess is that they left bald eagles as a symbol for male organizations, male endeavors, of all sorts, because it does give the sense of a masculine species. And I should point out that female bald eagles and male bald eagles look identical, except that, and here's another irony, which I love historical irony of all sorts, is the female weighs 20% more than the male. And when you put a male beside a female, she is noticeably larger than her mate.
That's Jack E. Davis. He's a professor of history at the University of Florida. His new book is The Bald Eagle, The Improbable Journey of America's Bird. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Thanks to KUER's mobile app, you can keep NPR Utah as your essential connection wherever you go. Our free mobile app keeps you informed with the latest local stories from KUER News. Explore on-demand podcasts like Radio West, State Street, and Sent Away. Or enjoy nonstop streams of our daily programming, BBC World Service, and classical KUER. Stay connected to your member station with the KUER mobile app, available for free wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the environmental writer Jack E. Davis is with us, talking about his new book, The Bald Eagle. It's a cultural and natural history of these birds, and it explains how we Americans made them our national symbol and still nearly eradicated them from the earth twice. So the book is a success story, and it explains how eagles plotted out their own story as natural beings. Let's talk about the natural history you explore of eagles in the book. Put the numbers in perspective for us, Jack Davis. Before white settlers arrived in North America, how many bald eagles were there here?
Well, you know, like with native populations, indigenous populations, we can only guess. But yeah. The high estimate is that there were some 500,000 bald eagles across North America when the first Europeans arrived.
Abundant and widespread. And the widespread part is, I think, something that you mentioned, people seeing eagles all the time in Philadelphia and places where you wouldn't expect eagles. Say something about that part. They were everywhere in this continent, I guess.
They were everywhere from coast to coast, throughout Canada, Alaska, into northern Mexico, not much farther south than northern Mexico. And let me give you an example. At the time that Congress adopted the Great Seal of the United States with the bald eagle on the front in 1782, bald eagles were nesting along the Delaware River every mile or two. And so they were a very common sight throughout the 13 original states, but also across the continent. And as Americans crossed the continent, they saw bald eagles wherever they went.
You mentioned that eagles, as you said, sort of pursued this, you know, natural instinct for survival, and they plotted out their own story as natural beings, is how you put it in the book. Talk about this is how you've described it. They have ideal family values, you've said. Talk about that part of their natural history, their fidelity to each other, but also their fidelity to a place, to their nest.
Yeah, one of the things I really admire about the bald eagles is that they have what I like to refer to as ideal family values. They mate for life. And they maintain a fidelity to the same nest for as long as that nest exists. If it's lost, say in a storm or the nesting tree falls, they'll rebuild immediately and they'll rebuild in the same territory. And they raise their young with such devotion and such care. They feed them so well that by the time the young are ready to leave their natal territory, usually between 16 and 20 weeks of age, they typically weigh more than the parents. And the juveniles, their first year, are a chocolate brown when they leave their natal territory. But if they had white heads and white tails, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the adult bald eagle and the juvenile. And the juveniles, remember, at the end of breeding season, they will migrate. They will fly off somewhere else. The southern bald eagles tend to fly north, northern bald eagles south. But when breeding season comes back around again, the juveniles will often return to their natal territory in their nest because they remember how well mom and dad fed them. Quite often, mom and dad have to chase them away because they have a new brood that they're raising.
One of the things you mentioned in the book is just how killing bald eagles in the 19th century was really common. There's the story you tell of a person named Artie Kirker went shooting in, I think it was 1888, in a park in Washington Heights in Manhattan. And the reason we know this, I guess, is the story is sort of laid out in the New York Times. But talk a little bit about this particular moment and just how this conveyed the way people just, even though it was the national symbol, even though, you know, was perceived as this noble creature, sorry, this noble symbol anyway, it wasn't uncommon for people to just kill them.
It was very common, unfortunately, for Americans to kill bald eagles throughout the 19th century and on into the early 20th century. While Americans love the image of the bald eagle, and they put it on so many things, you know, in decorative arts and business and organizational logos and sports teams uniforms, they very much dislike the species. And a bald eagle seen was a bald eagle to be shot. And I, when I was doing my research, I did a search in the newspapers with the date range of 1850 to 1920. And I came up with, using three words, bald eagle shot. And I came in quotation marks, and I came up with over 140,000 hits. And you read these articles, and rarely are the newspapers condemning the shooting of a bald eagle. Instead, they report the shooting of a bald eagle like John or Jane caught a 15-pound largemouth bass down at the lake. Mm. And always they would report the wingspan and the weight of the eagle. Again, rarely condemning it. So by the time that Artie Kirker in 1888 went on his hunt to shoot a bald eagle in Highland Park in Manhattan, bald eagles had become a rare sight in New York. And throughout the eastern seaboard states, they were so rare in the east and many Midwestern states that Americans thought that bald eagles were Rocky Mountain birds. They had forgotten that bald eagles had once been prolific on the East Coast. And so Artie Kirker was going after a trophy. Two bald eagles were seen in the city, and it became big news. And so Artie Kirker got his gun out and indeed shot a bald eagle and then had it mounted.
It gets to this idea, this myth that you write about in the book, that bald eagles were perceived as a threat to society. And there's this film that was made in 1908 called Rescued from an Eagle's Nest, which really literally illustrates this myth that takes hold. Talk about this.
Americans, including ornithologists, all sorts of experts, all sorts of quote-unquote eyewitnesses maintain that the bald eagle not only stole livestock that was too heavy for it, but mothers were warned not to leave their infants unattended outdoors lest they want a bald eagle carried away to their nest. And this myth continued well into the 20th century, and even today you can see doctored videos on YouTube of eagles flying off with a baby, you know, a one-year-old or so from a city park. It's completely bogus. There's zero evidence that bald eagles ever stole a human child. Yet, in 1908, Edison Studios put out a silent film, which you can watch on YouTube, by the way. It's you watch the entire film. It runs about 12 minutes. The film was titled Rescued from an Eagle's Nest, and it's the story of a lumberjack who lives out in the woods with his wife and young child who is left outside one day and to play by itself, and it is stolen away by an eagle and taken to its nest. And the father ultimately rescues the child and triumphs over the eagle.
What was that about? Because you say that this idea in popular culture of these eagles is, you know, kidnappers. It kind of, I think this is how you describe it in the book, it kind of gave the green light for ranchers and then farmers to just kill eagles because they thought they needed to protect their livestock.
Yes, because of these myths about eagle kidnapping and thievery, it was seen as a public duty to shoot and kill bald eagles. Ranchers did it, thinking that they were protecting their livestock. Fishermen in Alaska in particular shot bald eagles, maintaining that they were unnecessary competition for the salmon industry, even though bald eagles tend to prey on spawned out salmon, which are not marketable. And it wasn't just ranchers and fishers who were killing bald eagles, but Americans generally. I mean, in the 19th century, a lot of people had raise chickens in their backyards. And indeed, bald eagles can carry away a chicken. And so even if you didn't have chickens, even if you were not a livestock farmer, you typically, if you saw a bald eagle, you went for your gun and you shot it.
The curious element to these stories, something that you just mentioned, it's like a theme. You say that no animal in American history has been, you know, the simultaneous object of reverence and then also recrimination at the same time. So eagles, even though they're branded as threats, they're shot in the, you know, hundreds or thousands, they still remained an important symbol for the country. How do you explain that?
You know, again, I think I explain it by, you know, just contradictions within, you know, ourselves and that I think are common to humanity. As I write in the book, the bald eagle existed, at least how I see it, in two universes. There was a symbol universe in which it was revered, and there was a species universe in which it was reviled. And until science really got to know the bald eagle better, and until we pushed it to the brink of extinction and recognize the duplicity and potentially losing the living species behind this really powerful symbol, a symbol that was recognized across the world. Not until then did we decide to provide protection for the bald eagle, to see the error of our ways. And that's when Congress in 1940 passed the Bald Eagle Protection Act.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that part, because one of the things you mentioned in the book is there are two parts to the story, two times in our history when Americans took eagles to the brink of extinction and then managed to bring them back. I mean, two times here. So there's this effort to basically slaughter them. Maybe say a little bit about the effort to stop that slaughter. And Rosalie Edge is a good person maybe to talk a little bit about here.
Yeah. So on into the early 20th century, Americans were still slaughtering bald eagles and without any condemnation. I mean, even ornithologists endorsed it. And in 1917, the territory of Alaska adopted a bald eagle bounty to, as it said, protect the salmon industry. So if you turn in a set of talons, you could collect 50 cents from the territory of Alaska. And there were many Americans who were alarmed by this, wanted to stop the bounty, wanted to stop the slaughter in the lower 48. They found it very difficult to find ornithologists to come on board with their position. Many of them turned to the National Audubon Society, which at that time was the most influential and best-funded conservation organization that, you know, was dedicated to protection of bird life. But even the leadership of National Audubon refused to call for the protection of the bald eagle or challenge the Alaska bounty. So others took it upon themselves. And one of the leaders of that effort was Rosalie Edge, who was from New York and a member of Audubon. And after Audubon refused to take a stand against the bounty and to protect bald eagles or call for bald eagle protection, she started her own organization, the Emergency Conservation Committee, to expose the duplicity in Audubon, but also to push for Congress to protect the bald eagle. And she and others succeeded at that.
Yeah. Yeah. As you just mentioned, there was the Bald Eagle Protection Act of 1940. How significant was that moment? Because you say that the laws protecting the bald eagles after that time were impressive, it seems.
The 1940 Bald Eagle Protection Act was really a turning point, not only for the bald eagle, but also I believe in the protection of wildlife, because before the Bald Eagle Protection Act, a number of birds had protection under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the Weeks and McLean Act, but no raptor did. Raptors were not included under the 1918 Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And so when Congress passed the Bald Eagle Protection Act in 1940, it was extending protection to an apex species, a predator animal, a raptor. But it was also, with that law, it was extending protection to a single species. The bald eagle got its own federal law protecting it. Congress has, on a number of times since 1940, amended the act to expand protection and stiffen the penalty for violators of the act.
That's Jack E. Davis. His new book is The Bald Eagle, The Improbable Journey of America's Bird. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listeners can hear KUER on the radio across Utah. Beyond the dial, there are many ways to stay connected to NPR Utah. Enjoy our free live stream at KUER.org. Take us wherever you go with the KUER mobile app. And if you have a smart speaker, find us there, too, by saying play KUER. Explore all the ways to stay connected at KUER.org/listen.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the environmental writer Jack E. Davis. We're talking about his new book, The Bald Eagle, The Improbable Journey of America's Bird. So we get to the brink of extinction, certainly the incredibly limited numbers. Then we respond, right? And there's this Bald Eagle Protection Act. It's quite significant. 5 years later, DDT is released to the general market. Talk about this moment, because then we start heading in the other direction, I guess.
Yeah, so just as the bald eagle population is potentially recovering, DDT is released to the general market in August 1945, and Americans fall in love with this. The post-World War II period is not just simply the atomic age. It was also the chemical age. All sorts of chemicals came out on the market. Many of them had been used and developed during World War II and played their role in important roles often in the war. But Americans fell in love with these chemicals. They had beaten the Germans. They had beaten the Japanese. Now they wanted to beat the bugs. And DDT could be bought at your local grocery store. And people took it home and used it. It was used widely throughout agriculture. It was used widely throughout forestry. It was regarded as this miracle chemical. So consequently, Americans spread DDT from coast to coast across the United States, primarily the lower 48 states. And not only did it affect bald eagle population, but it also had a devastating impact on falcons, peregrine falcons, and on osprey, and all sorts of bird life and fish life. And, you know, it ruined the fishing habitat of bald eagles.
The pelican you mentioned in Louisiana.
The pelican in Louisiana, the state bird that disappeared from the state. Yes.
1963, you say, the number of nesting eagles. Now, compared to what we said before, some, you know, hundreds of thousands, 500,000 maybe. By 1963, the number is less than 500?
The number of nesting pairs across the lower 48. And dropped to less than 500. The bald eagle's in trouble once again.
Who made the connection? At what point? You mentioned a person by the name of Charles Broley. Who finally makes the connection that this is what's killing so many birds?
Yeah, Charles Broley is an interesting person. He was a retired banker from Winnipeg who moved to Tampa, Florida in the 1930s. And he began climbing 60, 70, 80 foot tall pine trees to band eaglets. And he wasn't a scientist, and nobody else was doing this at the time. He's the first person to systematically band eaglets, and he did so for 20 years from 1939 to 1959 till the age 79. And Doug, he never fell out of a tree. Climbed some, he estimated over 1,100 trees in those 20 years. But he's on the front lines, and he begins to notice in the 1950s the bald eagle population declining. He's starting to see fewer and fewer active nests. He is starting to see fewer and fewer nests that were active to be successful nests. He's seeing more nest failures throughout the years. And he corresponds with others who are monitoring bald eagle nests in other parts of the country. And he's getting the same reports. And he's very much aware of the use of DDT around the country and its impact on some wildlife. And he's one of the first people, if not the first person, to make a connection between the declining bald eagle population and DDT. And in fact, Rachel Carson talks about him in Silent Spring. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Gets us in the story to 1972, which you've described as this kind of turning point for the sort of environmental consciousness. Talk about how important that year was.
Yeah, 1972 was a watershed year for both the bald eagle and the American people. The early 1970s saw a string of unprecedented, Congress passed a string of unprecedented environmental laws. And 1972 was a particularly busy year. And that year, William Ruckelshaus, who was head of the EPA, appointed by Richard Nixon, took the very brave move to ban the sale of DDT in the United States. In 1972, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife increased the penalties for harming a bald eagle. And that year, Congress added the raptors to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. But also that year, 50 years ago, this October, Congress passed the Clean Water Act. At that time, barely one third of the nation's waters, fresh water and salt water, were safe for swimming and fishing for humans. So not only had we wreaked havoc with the bald eagle habitat, we also despoiled our own habitat. We muddied our own nests, fouled our own nest. But with these chess pieces in place, 4 years later on the nation's bicentennial, U.S. Fish and Wildlife launched bald eagle restoration programs across the country.
Mm. By 2007... the nesting population of bald eagles is 11,000 growing. And then I don't know what happens in 2010, but you've mentioned the bald eagle population quadrupled.
Yes, the bald eagle population quadrupled. And I think we can attribute that population explosion or boom, if you will, to both what we did in changing our ways, passing unprecedented environmental laws. Clean Air Act, which was passed in 1970, was extremely important because that helped clean up waterways and the watery habitat of bald eagles. You know, you can have all the protective legislation in the world. You know, you can throw somebody in jail for harming a bald eagle. But if we had not cleaned up the bald eagle's habitat, the population could not have come back. So that population boom in the 2010s is evidence of how well we've cleaned up the environment, that we've done something right by the environment. But also it's attributable to the bald eagle itself and its instincts for survival and those ideal family values.
How close did we get, do you think, to losing the eagle?
You know, in the lower 48, I think we got, in the 1960s, pretty close. I really, truly think it was on the brink. The population was still fairly healthy in Alaska, despite the bald eagle bounty lasting until 1952. But, you know, Alaska is not known as an agricultural region. And so it wasn't blanketed with as much DDT as the lower 48. So the bald eagles were able to escape, for the most part, that peril. But we could have lost the bald eagle in the lower 48. There's no doubt about that.
You mentioned in the book that our reconciliation with the bald eagle would not be complete without recognizing the sacred role it plays in indigenous cultures. And you write about the bald eagles and their connection with indigenous people. Say something about that part, how important it is to understand that part as well.
Native groups have had a relationship with bald eagles dating back thousands of years. For many native groups, bald eagles are regarded as spirit birds. They're messengers between the people and their lost ancestors and the higher spirit or the creator. And their body parts, their feathers and talons are considered conduits to that other world. So bald eagles have often their feathers in particular, but other body parts are part of important religious ceremonies for many native groups. And native peoples took bald eagles out of the wild. There was typically a designated eagle catcher or eagle hunter who went through elaborate rituals before taking a bald eagle out of the wild, again, to be used for religious ceremony or rituals. But native peoples did not take them in excess. They did not push bald eagles to the brink of extinction. And when Congress passed the 1940 Bald Eagle Protection Act, which was a good thing for the bald eagle, although it exempted Alaska and its bounty, it did not exempt the traditional, you know, relationship native peoples had with bald eagles. So the 1940 Bald Eagle Protection Act actually criminalized ancient native behaviors. And even today, that remains true, although except there are exceptions. U.S. Fish and Wildlife has worked closely with many native groups to ensure they are able to acquire feathers and body parts to raise and care for bald eagles and aviaries, bald eagles that are flightless, you know, that have been rescued and rehabilitated. There are some 7 native aviaries now around the country, bald eagle aviaries. You know, and for us, as I write in the book, our relationship has been based primarily on the bald eagle as a symbol, the bald eagle as a species. But I think because, you know, a generation of us, I'm a baby boomer. I didn't grow up with bald eagles. And I grew up in Florida. I never saw bald eagles. And we're seeing them in such great numbers in such frequency today that I think that we are so excited to see it. I think we've really formed a relationship on another level besides, symbol and species. I think we've formed a relationship with bald eagles, many of us, that is, more along the lines of spiritual, coming close to that of native peoples.
Well, it gets us to the kind of the final reflection you offer in the book. It's kind of this reflection on healing and a reference to how the eagle has been used in Western religious teaching, how, spirit birds appear in biblical stories, a psalm in the Bible, for example, you mentioned on eagle's wings. This idea of an eagle delivering peace. President Biden invokes it in that psalm in his victory speech. Say something about that symbolically now. How are you seeing eagles at sort of this moment as maybe being symbolic of something?
I think the bald eagle still symbolizes strength and courage and sovereignty. But I also believe that the bald eagle is a symbol of our own changing sensibilities toward nature. When we see one crossing the sky, it's a poke the guy in the ribs next to you moment of excitement.
Yeah.
It's really, as I write in the book, when we see that bald eagle crossing the sky, it's a pat on the back of ourselves for doing something right, not only for the bald eagle, but for living differently and in a more stable relationship with nature. And we all benefit from that. The bald eagle's comeback in the late 20th and early 21st century has really, I truly believe, improved our own quality of life. I don't think Americans could imagine living without the bald eagle again.
Jackie Davis, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jack E. Davis. He's a professor of history at the University of Florida. His book is The Bald Eagle, The Improbable Journey of America's Bird. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Kerry Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.